Welcome back to Projector Room. It's show 203, and as usual these days, with Alan gone, it's me and Gareth. I hope we're not boring you with just the two of us. Hello, everyone, and hello, Gareth.
Well, hello there, young Ted. What a lovely evening for us to be doing this.
You sounded like Terry Wogan then. Just like Terry Wogan.
I hear that
Wogan.
Quite a lot. It's either Eamon Holmes or Terry Wogan. I get the two. That's not a bad thing.
You don't normally sound like him, but you just did then. Right, it's Wednesday the 4th of February, and we are here to bring you lots of interesting stuff, hopefully, with regards to film, cinema and TV. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website. And the MeWe group is where we scoop up stuff from you. So keep that coming, please. And we'll come to your reviews and suggested viewing in a moment after Gareth hits the news. Oh, the first one was mine. This was the BBC TV license thingy doing a deal with YouTube. I'll see if I can get this right. So the idea here is that they're going to abolish the, or get rid of the TV license, do a deal with YouTube, put all of the BBC's content onto YouTube, and then if people don't pay Google for a YouTube subscription, then they'll have to get advertising in the BBC content. As but if they pay YouTube the $11.99 a month or whatever it is, then they will be able to see BBC content in the same way as they can now, with no adverts in it. And this is supposed to be all happening by about 2028, I think it was. But it could mean that the £175 TV license bill could be scrapped. And we'll have to see what happens. But that will also mean, presumably, that anyone that wants to watch ITV or Channel 4 or whatever won't then need a TV licence and can watch it for free. Did you see this story, know anything about it?
I did, yes. There was a couple of additional points that I wanted to make on it. And they're going to be making particular content for YouTube as well that's not going to go out on the BBC, so they're going to make specific shows for YouTube, which I think is going to be an interesting way to do it, because I think some people may be annoyed that if they're paying the TV license and they don't use YouTube, what are they going to end up being able to avail of in such a way? But they're also looking to somehow work the TV license into people who are watching Netflix. And there's quite a lot of grey areas around that. It will require a substantial change to the law for them to be able to push this through. But there is an angle that they're working from, because it says in the TV licensing guidelines or rules and laws that a live performance is whenever people are there's more than six or seven people or something in an audience.
Right.
And that qualifies a live performance. So if you have all your mates around, all your friends around or whatever, and all their friends as well, because, you know, having two friends around isn't enough. You've got to get them to bring their friends as well to push it up to seven or eight. Mm-hmm. Then watching a movie would then become essentially a live performance, and that could be licensable. But, you know, it is a real grey area. Right. So there's a lot of people who are watching this to see exactly what's going to happen there. And the general consensus is, I think they're on YouTube, there's a guy called the Black Belt Barrister, I think his name is. And he does a pretty good summary of the legalities of it. And he doesn't see anything changing anytime soon. But the YouTube thing is likely to happen, and it could be quite a good thing. It could shake things up a wee bit, and if they get rid of the TV license, I'm sure that'll please many people. But I do have one little thing about the TV license, and I can't help but think this, and that's because I, working in America for a number of years, I had to put up with cable and all their highly advertised TV channels, you know, with ticker tapes going across the bottom and ad breaks every 5 minutes or whatever. But then coming back and sitting down the BBC, and I know I've banged on about this a number of times in the past, sitting down and watching an hour's worth of programming on the BBC, you watch an hour's worth of programming. It's not 40 minutes with a bunch of ads thrown in there. You know, Top Gear was a good example where you watch an hour of Top Gear, but then you go and watch it on, what is it, Dave or whatever the channel is that it's on, Sky, and it's there for an hour, but you only get 40 minutes worth of it, and it's chopped up with adverts. And I think it's really nice to be able to sit down and know that you're going to be watching a proper piece of entertainment for the length of time that's there without advertising. If you watch a movie on the BBC, it doesn't stop to try and sell you a Cornetto and then start again. So I like the idea, and I do appreciate the TV license for that novelty, because I think it is a novelty. It's the last of that type of TV viewing. And once it goes away, it's not likely to come back. Or, you know, if you pay for YouTube Premium, you still have to put up with the sponsored segments, which you can skip over, but you have to skip over them. That's like fast forwarding through the ads.
It depends on what ITV. It depends on what you watch, though, because my dad never sees adverts on YouTube, because the things he watches are so completely unpopular that no one else will ever want to watch them. So no one bothers putting adverts on them. So it does depend on some degree. Because I say to him, I can't believe that you sit and watch YouTube and put up with adverts. And he says, I never see adverts. And then we started to look at what he was watching, and it was just these off the wall things that he's watching that no one else would bother watching. So they're only targeting adverts in YouTube content if it's popular enough, by the looks of it.
But also the YouTube Premium family thing, that really helps bring it all together. But, it'll be interesting to see what happens on this. The next bit of news is that there is going to be a sequel to Event Horizon, which I'm sure a lot of people are very, very excited about. However, it is actually a comic book sequel, which is going to depress many people. But, you know, it's one of those things that if it becomes a bit of a hit or whatever, there is a potential that it could suddenly become a thing. There was another one, I think, called Event Horizon Dark Descent, which was a previous printing, but Event Inferno follows up the events of the actual film, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. I'm quite looking forward to that. It's nice to be able to pick up a comic book every now and again and have a wee read at it, because it's a much quicker way of being able to take in a sequel than sitting down and reading a whole novel or whatever. So, some people might be interested in that, just to see where it goes to next. You liked Event Horizon, didn't you?
I loved the film, but I had no idea about any comics. But the film was great. I really enjoyed it. And, it's mind-boggling stuff. So I'm all for that.
Cool. Well, there's one thing you're certainly going to be all for, and that's Ana de Armas starring in a psychological thriller called Sweat, which is something I'm sure you'll be doing, Durant. This is it's directed by Jay Blakeson, and it's based on a Polish film that premiered at Cannes back in 2020. Ana de Armas will play Emma Kent, an ambitious fitness influencer, so there you go, you've got her in her yoga pants, Ted, whose life unravels after a disastrous encounter with her idol leads to a dangerous arrangement with an obsessed fan. It's going into production on March the 30th and should be out some point after that. I thought I did see it in there, but maybe dates are difficult to tie down, especially with Ana de Armas. She's probably quite difficult to tie down to.
Indeed.
There you go. That's one to add to the list, eh, Ted?
Yep. Cool.
All right.
Nothing to add, because you know all the things that I've got to add to that will be just gratuitous slurping. Yes.
And we don't need the listeners to have that in their ear holes.
No.
Well, a new forgotten raw extended version of Gremlins has been unearthed Now, this has been rumored for years, but it's 160 minutes long, and it's the assembly cut of the 1984 Gremlins movie that was put together by Joe Dante. He's alleged to have mentioned it in the past in interviews, and the current version, or the theatrical version, was 106 minutes, so it's got 54 minutes of extra footage in there. Did you like that? I did some maths there.
Well done.
Calculator. So it's the Gremlins Museum that has received tapes containing the early rough cut of the Dante film, and it's the true grail for Gremlins fans. It was made 6.5 months, or 6.5 months, I think that translates to, before the film's premiere, so it was obviously just chopped down. That's really exciting to think that there's another version of Gremlins out there that we could potentially get. But given that it's tapes that have been donated to the museum, it's going to be one of those work prints that you see. And I know where you've had work prints in the past, they're never quite as good quality. They're probably ruby VHS quality, if anything. So I wouldn't get too excited about having a 160-minute 4K version of Gremlins arriving on disc anytime soon. Likely this will just be a nice little extra that gets thrown on to a boutique label at some point in the future. Would you be watching a Gremlins 160-minute cut, Ted?
I don't know what Gremlins is. I think it's a Disney kids film from the 1980s, isn't it?
No, it's not. You'd probably quite like it then, will you? I'll add that to your list. It's a nice little horror comedy. It's a wee bit violent. It's not terribly violent, but it's not good enough for kids. And I remember watching it when I was about 5 or 6, and it scared the living shit out of me. The sequel's a wee bit tamer again, but the first one's very much worth watching. I think you'd like it.
Really? From what I have seen of it in clips and clipettes and whatever, it just looks like a Disney film, which we'll come to a bit later, incidentally. Anyway, all right, okay, fair enough. All right.
Oh, it's far from it. There's Gremlins, there's Critters, and there's Ghoulies, and I think you should watch all three of those franchises. You'll be... Yeah.
And there's no children in them.
There are children. I think Leonardo DiCaprio was in one of the Critters movies, and there's a kid in Gremlins, but they're not the star.
Groups of children running around with little creatures chasing them, and all I know of it is just it stinks of Disney.
No, it's not. If children are there, they're very much in the background.
Okay.
Or they've just got the old wisecrack or something there.
All right.
Yeah. All right, the last one, just before the show, was a thing I saw on Twitter, and it's worth mentioning because I'm dead excited. A24 have acquired the film rights to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and they've announced that they are going to be doing a feature film, which is currently in development, and alongside a TV series, which is going to be executive produced by Glenn Powell, who, memory serves, he's the guy from Top Gun and The Running Man and things. He's the hottest property in Hollywood at the moment, and directed by J.T. Molnar, who did The Long Walk, that Stephen King film that Mark Hamill was in.
Oh, we're coming to that
came
later.
Out a couple of months ago. Yeah. So I'm really excited about that. A new Texas Chainsaw Massacre would be cutting.
Yeah. Okay. I think we spoke about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre quite recently on the show, and I think I said then that I can't remember anything about it. I watched it in the 80s when it came out or whenever it was, and I think I saw it at the cinema, but I can't remember anything about it except there's a bloke running around with a hockey mask on and a chainsaw.
Hockey mask is a different franchise, but yeah, he is wearing a mask.
Right.
But it's worth revisiting. I think you should binge the entire series one weekend. I'd like to see you after that.
You're stacking me up with a load of homework here. That's 3, 4, 5, that's about 6 films so far, and we're only 5 minutes in.
Yeah, well, get cracking. Have you done Gremlins yet?
Yes. Right, what else have we got? Any more news?
No, that'll do. That's
okay.
Let's, or did I miss one? No, I don't think so.
Let's launch into suggested viewing and reviews from listeners then. And the first is from Chad Dixon, and it's H is for Hawk, 2025 film based on Helen MacDonald's celebrated memoir. This drama stars a superb Claire Foy as a Cambridge academic spiralling after the sudden death of her father, played by Brendan Gleeson. Seeking to fill the chasm left by her grief, Helen makes the radical decision to adopt and train an inexperienced goshawk. Is that how you say that word? Goshawk, I suppose it is. Named Mabel. Goshawk, right? As Helen immerses herself in the world of falconry, she becomes increasingly withdrawn from her work and family. While the human cast is solid, including Denise Goff and Lindsay Duncan, Mabel the Goshawk is, honestly, before this week, I'd never, ever seen that word in my life. I don't know.
Neither have I.
Goshawk is the true star. Whether perched on Helen's arm amidst the dreamy spires of Cambridge or soaring through the English countryside during beautifully filmed golden hours, the bird is a magnificent presence, says Chad. Director Philippa Lowthorpe delivers a straightforward, moving adaptation. Foy's performance perfectly captures the unravelling of an organised woman consumed by abject loss. At 1 hour, 55 minutes, it's a poignant exploration of how we navigate the wider shores of grief. And I do actually quite fancy this. I think it's got the... I'll link in the show notes to Chad's full-length review. That's a gem, a cut-down. It does sound like it's very, very good and moving and thoughtful and intelligent and not a bloody American comedy. So I shall be definitely watching this when I can get to it.
Does sound pretty good, actually, yeah. And H is for Hawk is a cool name as well, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm glad they made it about a hawk. There's a bird, isn't there, called the cock of the walk or something like that, or cock of the rock, I think it is.
Right.
Cock of the rock, yeah.
Okay.
And one called a booby, that's what it was, booby.
I've got a feeling that
he's for booby.
I got a feeling that he went to the cinema to see that, so it probably isn't yet available for us mere mortals.
Right, okay. Well, sounds good. Irfan Ali watched Thief from 1981, the Michael Mann film starring the late, great James Caan and James Belushi. I like throwing that in because people always go, really? Michael Mann and James Belushi? Yeah, James Belushi, and he's good in this film. It's an early effort from Michael Mann with a cracking score by Tangerine Dream. A master safecracker likes to break into high-end safes and steal diamonds. He is trying to create the perfect life for himself and his family. His fence is thrown out of the window, still owing him $180,000. He has to get alongside a shady crime boss in an effort to get paid. James Caan is electric on screen, commands every scene he's in. There's an impressive supporting cast and some early appearances by James Belushi and Dennis Farina. Tuesday Weld and Willie Nelson are also in it. Willie Nelson, he's a guitar player, isn't he?
Yeah, country boy, isn't he?
Yeah, but I think he's in quite a lot of films, actually.
Or is that Nilsson? Maybe that's Nilsson. Well, no, that was the serial killer, wasn't it? Dennis Nilsson.
Maybe slightly different. I really enjoy this, and at his 2-hour-plus runtime seemed to fly by, and he gives it 7 out of 10. That's a good scoring, Irfan. I'm quite pleased with that. I came to this film with a lot of people going, oh, wow, it is the most amazing film you'll ever see in your whole entire life, which is a tall order. And when I sat down, I enjoyed it and I walked away from it. And I don't remember that much about it now because it's been a while. But it certainly wasn't cracked up to be the most amazing film ever. But it is very, very good. And it's that film that everybody knows James Caan for because he's so good in it. And it put Michael Mann on the map. Yeah, good film. Have you seen that, Ted?
I promised to watch this when Alan brought it to the show months and months ago, and of course I never got round to it. I did see it coming, and I tried to find the time and enthusiasm to watch it this week, but I didn't get round to it. I was too busy watching horror films. But I will get to it. It does sound as though it's interesting, and I did like Tangerine Dream, well, at least one or two of their albums. So that'll be interesting to hear the score. Anyway, and we'll come back to Michael Mann a bit later, won't we?
Yeah. And also, it's another film to add to this ever-growing list that you've developed tonight.
Adrian Brain is next on The Surfer, a 2024 film. And he says, it's a trippy psychological drama that is as funny as it is intense. Nick Cage delivers a performance impossible to imagine anyone else topping. He carries the audience through a story that is far deeper than it first appears. The plot follows a wealthy businessman attempting to buy his childhood home to save his disintegrating family. However, he is soon confronted by a local gang led by the superb Julian McMahon. Adopting the mantra, don't live here, don't surf here, they use violence to bar him from the waves. As his son departs, the drama unfolds entirely within the beach and parking lot, stripping the protagonist back to his core. The film's visual style is super vivid, featuring saturated colours and ethereal flashbacks set to a stylized 50s soundtrack. While the script explores toxic masculinity and the hollow pursuit of property, it works on multiple levels, like literal, a gripping, tense confrontation, literary, reminiscent of J.G. Ballard novel, where a character subconsciously undermines their life to find a way forward. Though polarizing for some, I loved its precision and deliberate ambiguity. It's highly recommended. Eat the Rat. I don't know what Eat the Rat means, do you? Eat the Rat.
No, it's probably something from the film, I'd like to think, or perhaps Adrian is going through some stuff.
Anyway, I haven't seen
it. I remember the trailer for this, right. And it did look really good. It was one of those, I think most Nick Cage films, whenever the trailer arrives, you're like, actually, is this the one where he's sort of getting out of direct-to-video world? But it just seems to fall back into direct-to-video world. They all seem so interesting. But I don't know. I don't know if I could bring myself to watch it. But if Adrian says it's highly recommended, maybe we should. And also Julian McMahon, he's always good. I loved him. What was it? Nip Tuck he was in? Yeah.
Just to reread the line that Adrian wrote there about Nick Cage. Nick Cage delivers a performance impossible to imagine anyone else topping. So there you are, you see. Maybe the corner has been turned.
Well, I think that actually stands for most of Nick Cage roles. Once he plays someone, you can't imagine anyone else doing that role. Okay. Really can't.
All right.
Yeah. What was that one he made where he was, everybody dreamt about him? Everyone had the same dream one night, or he appeared in all of their dreams?
Don't add that to my list. I was watching this film the other day, and I was so annoyed because so much of it was you watching something going on, and then suddenly you realise they're waking up and it's a dream. You say, oh, for goodness sake, show me the real stuff, not some concoction in someone's dream. It's really confusing, you stupid people.
Didn't you watch Dallas back in the day?
One
of the seasons or two of the seasons were a dream.
Oh, yeah. I tried to avoid that like the plague. My sister was into that.
Yeah, that's how they brought Bobby back. Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, I know too much about that. It's unfair. Robert McCrowan has written in about Falling Skies. I remember this one, which is a TV series with Noah blah, 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 blah from ER that ran from 2011 to 2015. I had a friend who was a big fan of this show, and he loved, yeah, he kept banging on about it and telling me to watch it. I still haven't watched it, but I think Robert is going to do that too. I'm not sure if this was available in the UK when it came out. It was. But Netflix just added all five seasons, and I binged it. It's an old aliens have invaded the Earth and are killing and destroying thing again. But this one is quite well done. A band of survivors are fighting back, and for the storyline, it's mostly good with some twists and turns and knuckle-biting moments. There are even a few surprises that I didn't see coming. Sadly, as with so many of these American series, they decided to end it and rushed out the last couple of episodes. But it is still not to disappoint. So thanks, Robert. Yes, I have heard that that is a bit of a corker of a series. And I think was they were talking about bringing it back or doing a shorter story arc or something, or maybe the last season that they made was a wee bit later. I can't remember. There was something about it coming back because it is one of those terribly popular sci-fi shows that people said were cancelled too soon. Five seasons seems hardly cancelled too soon, but, well, Ted, have you seen that?
I haven't, but I did, after Robert wrote that, I did have a look at part of the first episode. I ran out of time, and it didn't immediately grab me, but I'll give it more of a chance. Talking of Robert, though, I did, and because he was a fan of Stranger Things, I did decide after we were speaking about it recently that I'd give it another go. He watched the whole thing, and apparently I think it was season 5 that's just come out. And he was liking it. When I started watching Stranger Things again, I watched the first two episodes, and it came back to me why I'd given it up before. And I must fight this off, because despite Winona Ryder being there, it just felt like a Disney film. It felt like an E.T. style thing with loads of little kids with goofy teeth and curly hair and their bikes and riding around the kind of rural town neighborhood. It stinks of Disney. So I need to get past that this time and push harder to get to the stuff, the meat of what's going on. Do you know Stranger Things?
I do. I watched the first season and gave up soon after that. But what I'm going to suggest, Ted, is that perhaps you should maybe watch some more Disney films, because you seem to be confusing things that are not Disney-like with Disney.
Yeah, okay. Right, well, one thing that is definitely not a Disney film is 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, which I think we had in Coming Soon quite recently. And we're back to Chad Dixon here, who has also put the whole of this review up on my blog, so I'll link to that in the show notes. And this is Gemma's summary of what he said. Shot back to back with last year's installment, The Bone Temple finds Spike, Alfie Williams, captured by a bizarre violent cult led by the sadistic Sir Lord Jimmy Crystal, Jack O'Connell. At the end of the first series, the last film, I do remember he'd kind of come across this crowd in the street in this kind of loads of rocks they put across the street. I think the suggestion is it's carrying on right from there. Forced into a lethal initiation at an abandoned water park, Spike is rebranded as Jimmy and pulled into the cult's reign of terror across a feral Britain. Parallel to this, Ralph Fiennes returns as Dr. Ian Kelson, guardian of a hilltop memorial of human remains, which was in the film before as well, which is The Bone Temple. Kelson's study of a sedated alpha infected suggests a world-changing possibility. The virus might finally be evolving towards sentience. This is a much grimmer, gorier entry than its predecessor, fully earning its 18 certificate with graphic scenes of mutilation and cannibalism. We'll come back to that later as well. However, Ralph Fiennes provides much-needed exuberance, particularly in a wild third act. Clocking in at 1 hour 50 minutes, the film moves fast and ends with a massive teaser. A familiar face from the original 2002 film returns to set up the trilogy's conclusion. It's a tough watch, but for fans of the franchise, it's an essential one. So, yeah, that's the summary of Chad's longer review. Link in the show notes to that. So, yes, The Bone Temple. I think, again, that's probably cinema only at the moment. Yeah, I'm sure it is. So he's obviously gone to the cinema. So that will be coming to streaming at some point soon. So thank you, Chad. And I guess you haven't been to the cinema to see this yet?
No, I haven't. I've still only seen the first one. I think I'm kind of waiting to binge these all to get them all together and do a week of them.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about seeing them. I don't want to go to the cinema to watch them, to be honest. I know some people are going to say, oh, you need to see them on the cinema screen. But I kind of wanted to get them all on 4K and have them all nicely there and work my way through them one by one.
Well, okay. Well, the second one is on streaming now as well. So it's only the third one that's not. But it's not probably on 4K streaming. So you'll have to wait, won't you?
Well, that would be about right.
Fandom focus, and it's my turn this time to be being the fan of something in our newish section, and I've decided to choose the novels of Thomas Harris, which is effectively the Hannibal quadrilogy. There was a book before that called Black Sunday, which is a completely different film and story altogether, but I loved The Silence of the Lambs.
I just ordered it on Blu-ray yesterday.
You ordered it? Oh, right, cool. I would like to watch it again. I've seen it so many times, to be honest. I think I know the script. The Silence of the Lambs was just mind-blowing for me. It won all the Oscars, as we know, well, most of them, and it was just mind-blowingly interesting and cool, and everyone in it and everyone about it was super cool. I can't criticise The Silence of the Lambs, I don't think, in any way, shape or form. One criticism is that Anthony Hopkins could have been in it more. I think the count of his on-screen time was something like 14 minutes in the end, and yet he was the one that got an Oscar for his performance. He was scary. They'd done it so well. It's such a good film. But that wasn't the first one. The first one was Manhunter, which is the link back to Man, which is this is the first adaptation of Thomas Harris's book Red Dragon, and this is the one that some people say is better than the 2002 Red Dragon. I'm not quite sure. If I had to put them in order, I think personally I'd just about put Red Dragon ahead of Manhunter, but they're certainly very good. And one of the reasons is that I wasn't that convinced by the Will Graham actor in Manhunter, and I thought that
William Peterson.
Yeah, and I thought in Red Dragon Norton did it better, frankly, but it was a slightly different adaptation. So anyway, they're both really, really good, and I thoroughly enjoy both of them. And there's something about the Tooth Fairy in Manhunter which does have a certain scary, sinister edge that is missing in Ralph Fiennes's Red Dragon 2002 version. So there are pros and cons in that. And then, after that, we've got Hannibal. This is the 2001 film, Hannibal, which was, by Anthony Hopkins' own admission, I think, everyone was just having a laugh with, really. So Thomas Harris wrote this book, Hannibal, in 1999. They jumped on it because of the popularity of the whole sequence. And I think it's quite good, personally. I think it's quite good fun. Clarice Starling is played by Julianne Moore. So that was a big change. And at first, when I first saw it, I thought, that's not Clarice Starling. That doesn't work, because Jodie Foster was so good. This is just spoiling it. But actually, the second and third time I watched it, I warmed to Julianne Moore. I thought that she did it really, really well. And she worked, the chemistry between her and Anthony Hopkins worked really, really well as well. So in the end, I got there. I still can't watch the end scene. I spoke about that before on the show. There's a scene where they're eating the brains of your favourite actor. What's his name?
Ray Liotta.
Yeah, Ray Liotta. And when I first saw this film in the cinema, I actually got up and left. It just made me so queasy. I got up from my seat and I left the cinema. And I've subsequently challenged myself to watch it on the TV screen. And every time it comes on, I feel queasy. And this is from someone that has faced all sorts of horrific, nasty, video nasty stuff. But there's something about that it just completely screws with my brain. So
I actually thought you meant you were going out to the concessions to get some nachos with salsa.
No, I just couldn't. I remember being all kind of lightheaded and dizzy, and I was really, it really affected me badly. And I still haven't actually fully seen the whole scene. I dare not watch it. Anyway.
Oh.
So that really odd bit of behaviour on the part of my psyche, obviously. Hannibal Rising was the last one. And I watched this week to remind myself, because this is the beginning story. Now, Thomas Harris wrote this in 2006, so after everything else, and then they made it into a film in 2007. And when I first watched this back in 2007 or 8 or 9, I thought, this is a lot of rubbish and it's all very silly. But I read the book. And the book is actually quite good, and it's about Hannibal's early life in Lithuania, where he was brought up, and it was war-torn Lithuania, which is a country just to the right of Poland, and it was at the end of the Second World War, and there's some horrific stuff going on with regards to explaining why Hannibal ends up like the sociopath he is, and particularly what happened to his sister, the soldiers that were in Lithuania and the stuff they did to him and his family. And it's quite harrowing in places. So I'm glad I watched it again and didn't just leave it in my memory as a bit of a dead loss, because actually I think it's worth watching. So my sequence of film order, which was where I was going to end up, is that I think in fifth place, I'll still put Hannibal Rising, even though I just said it was actually very good in the end. I'll put that as my fifth. The fourth one is the tongue-in-cheek Hannibal, which I can't watch the end of. and then, as I said earlier, Manhunter just about gets third place, behind Red Dragon in second. But The Silence of the Lambs is just to die for. I was watching some outtakes and stuff on YouTube the other day where they were interviewing the actors, and it's just so amazing to not have done that before. And the only reference I've got, for example, with Ted Levine, he who plays James Gunn, yeah. And you suddenly see him hugging Catherine Martin as they're off set and they're all having a meal together, and you think, oh yeah, I forgot, they're all actors, aren't they? These people are not real.
Yes, so, yeah, that's yeah. Right.
Anyway, yeah. So there you go. My bit of fandom focus is the Thomas Harris quadrilogy of all the Hannibal stuff. And I really, really loved all of it as it came out. And I'm glad now that I've rewatched the last one. So there you go. Any of that you've not seen?
No, I've been... Maybe I haven't seen Hannibal Rising. I think about it. I don't think I ever got around to that.
Right.
I haven't. on my Hannibal Walk set.
Ah.
But I've never given it a go. I just didn't fancy it. It seemed like a bit of a stretch.
Yeah. But I think the power of it is in the first half of it. When Hannibal gets out and he's an adult, the young adult Hannibal, that's when it becomes a bit of a stretch. But the first half of the film in his childhood, that's more harrowing and gripping.
Yeah. Well, I am a big fan of Manhunter. Back to Michael Mann, of course.
Yeah.
Which I'm not going to say I prefer it over Silence of the Lambs, but I hold it in the same high regard as Silence of the Lambs. I don't think it's fair to do that. It's kind of like From Russia with Love and Goldfinger, you know. They're just as good as each other, and maybe one day you prefer one over the other. Mm-hmm. But, it is a great series of films to be able to work your way through, and I've never had a problem with Hannibal, and I find it a bit odd that you have, given the content that you tend to like.
Yeah,
that's
bizarre, isn't it?
With at the moment.
Absolutely bizarre. Yeah. So I don't understand it. I really don't, and I couldn't describe it. And if I'd gone back to it on the TV screen and watched it fine, then you'd say, "Well, I must have just had an off day that day, or I'd eaten something or something." But no, even now, even now, if I try and watch it, I feel the same thing. It's very strange.
Yeah, it is quite peculiar. Hmm. Maybe it's channeling something that you have blocked out of your memory from when you were a child.
Someone was eating my brain.
Or you ate someone else's brain. That's entirely likely, I reckon.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, so is there... I take it there's no future plans for further movies?
Thomas Harris has written a book since there called something which I can't pronounce. Thomas Harris Books. And I haven't read it because it's something that is completely... Ah, here it is. Carrie Mora. I did buy it and I read... I started reading it and frankly, it bored me. I seem to remember it was set in Mexico or South America somewhere and it just wasn't taking off at all. It's nothing to do with Hannibal. It's just another novel. So I don't know if that is something that... I don't think it's been made into a film, or certainly not yet. That was 2019 that came out. But perhaps I should get back to reading.
Probably at some stage.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. And they'll probably remake another one day.
Yeah.
And what would you do if someone turned around and went, "They're remaking Silence of the Lambs"?
Uh-oh.
Fury.
They can't.
That was the reason why they did Red Dragon, wasn't it? Just because they wanted it to be more in keeping with the other films? I believe.
I'm not sure. I think that Manhunter follows the... You see, in Manhunter, one of the reasons that it doesn't get second place for me is that I'm not convinced by Brian Cox as Hannibal. Having known Hannibal as Anthony Hopkins, when I watched Manhunter after Silence of the Lambs, I thought he's just not Hannibal. And as much as I watched it, he was just too cold and clinical and ordinary and just not nasty enough and sinister enough. And he had none of the aspects of his character that Anthony Hopkins brought to it, and so I was just really disappointed with Brian Cox, and I thought, that's not right. Mm. Which is why one of the reasons I preferred Red Dragon, because they got Anthony Hopkins back in it, and that might be one of the reasons they did it again, remade it, because they wanted Hopkins to be in it.
Yeah. Well, because the story does follow us. Silence of the Lambs, then Manhunter, then Hannibal.
Terms of the books, the book sequence is Manhunter was first. The book sequence, Red Dragon was first. The Silence of the Lambs was second. Hannibal was third. And Hannibal Rising is fourth. So, yeah, the Red Dragon thing was first.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay. Right. That makes sense for Manhunter to be first.
No. The Red Dragon book was first.
Aye, but Manhunter's based on the Red Hand Dragon, though.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And they made Manhunter before Red Dragon, obviously.
And before Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, yes, that's right. 1986. So it all started with Manhunter in 1986 as an adaptation of Red Dragon, which was written in 81. And then the next thing was the Silence of the Lambs, yeah. And then they backtracked and thought, hang on a minute, we can do Red Dragon again, but with Anthony Hopkins in it. And so that's what they did. Anyway, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Well, that's a cool series of movies and the TV series.
Yeah. So your turn next time with your fandom focus.
Mm-hmm. I'll come up with something.
See what you bring.
Trashy.
Mm-hmm. Private screening is next.
Yes, yes. And I decided to challenge you to watch a particular movie that I remember from my teenage years that was recently released on Blu-ray, which I purchased because it came with the sequel bundled along on the disc, or on in the box, but on a separate disc. I hadn't seen the sequel, so I was kind of eager to get this little book, or this little collection, and it was called Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bowlerama. That was from 1988, and it's directed by your man, Dakota, and it comes from the Full Moon Library, which means it's cheap and nasty and designed entirely for thrills and tits, basically. Yeah, that's it. And I'm guessing that you had never seen this before. Had you even heard of it?
Nope, and I'm wishing I had never seen it now as well. I don't understand why anyone would want to watch this, let alone buy 4K Blu-ray specials of it. It's just a load of low-budget crap, really. It's badly produced, it's badly acted, it's badly scripted, it's badly shot. When you go onto YouTube and look at people reviewing this, it's always nerdy people with glasses and big teeth, and they talk in a nerdy voice. They say, yes, I've got this for my collection. And I thought to myself, well, you're not at all like that. You're very much not a nerdy type like that, but you're into this kind of thing of collecting this waste of time crap film stuff that I just don't get it. The tits and completely pointless, gratuitous tits and arse and spanking. They got spanking here and full frontal nudity in there as well. All with a bunch of teenage girls that are supposed to be teenage girls, but actually they look to me more like they're in their mid-30s, frankly. And I just don't get why anyone would waste their time and want to watch. There are a million and one other things to watch out there, including the things we just talked about. And why would anyone want to watch this? It's embarrassingly crap. Maybe it's because it's crap, they want. It's such a niche genre. Let's find as much crap and rubbish as we can. This is even worse than the whole Pooh Bear Humpty Dumpty thing, the British kind of claptrap that we've spoken about on the show as well. I just don't get it. I don't get why you would spend good money on this. And I reckon that if Alan was here, he would agree with me. And I just don't get it. Sorry.
I've got a funny feeling you're going to give it a fairly low score, maybe around the 5 mark or possibly even a 4. Well, so you wouldn't be open to doing Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers next then?
It's just, okay. Honestly, Gareth, at the risk of offending you, some of these things that you bring to the show, which I may obviously amuse you or they do something for you, and I think, oh, no, not one of those again. You bring, when we were doing those directors, you would bring directors that have just churned out crap like this over crap like this.
I was punishing you. Yeah.
And you obviously see stuff in it that is valuable to you. And I just don't understand why you would. I suppose it must be because it amuses you, because you think it's funny.
It's a difficult one to have to explain. I I have nostalgic memories of this. Nostalgic memories as well. But it was a it was a point where I had a particular friend who his father owned a video library, and I don't think it was a particularly good video library. It was up in the corner of the town, and it attracted maybe a lower rent of renters, rental people. He got a lot of just cheap stuff. He had the whole Full Moon catalogue, all of Trancers and all those sorts of films, the Subspecies and things like that. So whenever, you know, I would meet up with that friend, we'd grab a video to watch for the night. It would it'd invariably be one of these, something like that. And you're at the age where, oh, boobies, got to watch it. And I remember having a really good time watching it. Now, that's not to say that at the age of, 47, I think I am? Maybe at the age of 36 now, I'm more mature and sitting down and watching this, and I don't appreciate it as much as the likes of Goodfellas. And it's quite a difficult film to get through, and I did have a chuckle thinking, having to watch this fresh. And I'm wondering if he's going to get past the first, well, you'll get past the first 20 minutes because that's where most of the nudity is. But then the next 20 minutes, is he going to get past that? And whenever the plot actually starts to kick in, is he actually going to get to the point where Leanna Quigley gets into the film? So he can now say that he's watched a film with her in it, because she is a horror icon, a scream queen extraordinaire. So
is she the big blonde?
No, she's Spider. She's the small blonde who's breaking into the tills and a bit kick-ass. And she took that role because this was a film that she was able to keep her clothes on in, because most of the other acting jobs that she had around the time required a particular level of clothage. It's a bad film, but it is a grand film for being able to sit with some mates and beer and peanuts and things like that and just having a good laugh at. You don't have to get involved in the plot, and if you do get involved in the plot, it's going to start asking you more questions about yourself than is healthy. It's a terrible film. From paper to film, it is badly made. It's badly shot. It's badly lit. It's badly acted. And for that, I kind of forgive it, because it's not trying to be anything other than being a bad film, because bad films do sell. And if you go onto the internet and have a look at films like this, you'll find a whole slew, a whole market of direct-to-video films just like this that young people the same age as me at the time were quite happily renting out. And it provided the stars, the crew of the film regular work, that they were able to, you know, make something like this, like the lighting technicians and things like that, the cameraman that were on board this, or the camera people, would also be able to go and do adverts and TV shows and things like that, and here, there, and everywhere. So, you know, it's part of a constant, ongoing work routine for all the people who are involved, and that's actually quite important. The actors who are involved in it are, you know, probably SAG related, you know, the Screen Actors Guild. So they get to be able to get their rubber stamp to say that they were in a movie. So they get their health insurance for a year. So they're quite happy to do something like this that is low rent. And they try to come in as cheap as possible so that the rental fees will actually cover it, and they'll make a bit of money back, because they'll be able to sell it as part of Charles Band's Full Moon catalogue to video shops everywhere. The idea of the sequel that came about was, I think that Charles Band was, I think he did 10 films for Amazon or something like that, whenever COVID was just about to arrive. And I think the whole deal kind of fell apart, but the sequel was getting made, and they made a mistake in not getting Linnea Quigley back and using Kelly Maroney instead. And the film ended up being it's better made. Brink Stevens, who is in the first one, she directed the second one. She is a much better director than David Dakota. But the script and the acting is shoddy and the special effects are ropey, and it just doesn't have the same charm and impact of the first one. You know, I find this kind of film incredibly difficult to score, because I want to be able to give it a high score just because of nostalgia value. But I know it's not a good film in any stretch of the imagination. It's just bad. So giving it a high score is wrong. So I want to give it like an E out of 10. I think that'll be safe, an E.
Yeah, well, I can be more objective than you, and I can give it a 0. So, you know, whatever you give it is not going to get it past the halfway mark of our scoring.
No. It's out of 15, so that doesn't make me feel so bad. I think if it was out of 10, it would be harder to score. So I'm going to go with 8. Okay. I'm going to give it a wee bit more than halfway, because I think it does have its merits. Its heart is in the right place. It's badly made, but it allowed some people to do their job and to get another credit on their CV. Linnea got a straight acting gig where she didn't have to declothe, so that was worth something to her. And the sequel, I would give probably 7 to, because Brink did a better job directing it, but it's still crap.
Right, well, it's not bottom. It's, well, there are plenty of bottoms in it, but it's not bottom of our table. It's actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th from bottom.
Ah, okay.
In the company of Hitman, which I can't remember. Virgin River, I remember. Oh, that was just below. And C for me, I can't remember that either. My memory's shot. I can't remember half of these films. But then, suppose the ones down the bottom you don't need to remember, do you? Anyway, there you go.
Can you
then
watch C for me? I don't remember it in the slightest.
What's that?
I don't remember that in the slightest.
C for me. It's about, wasn't it about a girl who was...
Oh, on the phone. Yeah, she's visually impaired, right?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Vaguely. I can't remember why it was so crap, but it obviously was. Anyway, so yeah, well, thank you for that mind-numbing experience. It was very interesting. I have brought for the next show a choice for you too, a pure terror title, which we actually covered in Coming Soon in Projector and 191, called Keeper. A romantic anniversary trip to a secluded cabin turns sinister when a dark presence reveals itself, forcing a couple to confront the property's haunting past. And that's an Osgood Perkins film, which we covered before in Coming Soon, and that looks really spooky and interesting. But there's also another one I stumbled into, a Taiwanese thriller about this bomb on a plane, which also looks quite interesting. It's just arrived on Netflix a couple of months ago. A bomb expert and his fiance aboard a train in Taiwan containing explosives, while a scandal-plagued physics teacher takes the same train hopping to reconcile with his wife, who left on an earlier train. It's basically a bomb on a train story, and it looks like it's quite good fun. And if you don't fancy Keeper, then we could go back to that one. What do you reckon?
Well, actually, I do have to say it's got to be Keeper, because you put it in the show notes a few days ago and I clicked on it and thought, oh yeah, I'll quite enjoy that. And, you know, I built myself up to that.
Right.
So I have no desire to watch 96 right now. Maybe one day later. 96 minutes, sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. And if anyone wants to watch that, it is on Netflix. Keeper is on various streaming platforms. So we'll come back to the next show and talk about Keeper after we have both watched it. And I'm quite looking forward to that, actually. I think when we saw it in Coming Soon, we were all kind of even Alan, I think, was fairly fired up about that. Thought it might be very, very good. I think the production values were very good. So watch out for that one. Theme Treats is next, and it's our continuation of our 2026 theme of horror, and I chose Cannibalism. And ooh, so...
of course you did, you gore hound.
And last night, I saw one of the ones that you'd put into your list, and I decided to watch it, and I did, so I can join you in your appraisal of that one, if you'd like to take it away.
Okay, I'm wondering which one it is, because I put five in, but four of them are kind of all the same film. The first was Ravenous.
That's the one.
Okay. This kind of got me by surprise. I remember it coming out in the cinema, and I remember reading about it in Empire and Film Review, and they didn't give it very good reviews. I caught it on Channel 4, I think it was, one night, and really liked it. Robert Carlyle is insane in this. and Guy Pearce, who was the other guy in it? It was David Arquette. David Arquette was in there too. Ooh, Jeffrey Jones. Yeah, and I haven't actually watched it since, but I remember it being a film that I thought, this is much better than those reviews. This is really, really good and genuinely scary, with scary people and a ridiculous amount of blood. This is about a remote military outpost in the 19th century where Captain John Boyd and his regiment embark on a rescue mission that takes a dark turn when they're ambushed by a sadistic cannibal. yeah, well, you've watched it more recently than me, so maybe you could give it a bit of a closer analysis. Sounds like you enjoyed it.
I watched it last night, and I thought, as I was going through it, I thought, this is a comedy. And then I look back on IMDb, and sure enough, it says comedy horror or so, or dark comedy horror or something. And I thought, yeah. And at times, if you listen to the music, it was kind of breaking into Benny Hill-type music in the background. And I thought, yeah, they're having a laugh with this, aren't they? But actually, you're right. There's enough gore and blood and nastiness stuff going on it. And Robert Carlyle is just infectious. He plays the part so tongue-in-cheek, but also so well. And when the scenes come along where he's... required to be Mr. Nasty, he carries it off completely. He suddenly switches from the comic buffoon into the dark, nasty, sinister bloke. The whole story is put together well. There's some surprises in there, one of which I didn't see coming. And it was just a bit of a romp, really. And at the centre of it is this kind of nasty theme of cannibalism, where and seeing it through to the end, it's completely chaotic. That the finale of the film is just complete bonkers, and it's I'm going to spoil nothing for the content for people, but I think it's worth a watch. Does that ring any bells for you?
Not really. I do need to go back and revisit. I think it was released on 4. I had bought it. Was it another proposition? I can't remember which it was. One of Guy Pearce's films was released recently, and I grabbed it. I hope it's that one.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I'll have to rewatch it. I should have in time for this, but I was too busy watching Sorority Babes and the Slime Ball Bodorama 1 and 2 to get to this. Well, I also wanted to mention four films that I'm not even going to try to distinguish from each other, because I've seen all four of them and I don't remember which is which. There's Cannibal. They come in so many different titles as well. Cannibal is also known as Ultimo Mondo Cannibal in Italy. There's also Cannibal Holocaust, which is also known by a bunch of different titles too that I don't have in front of me. There is Cannibal Ferox, which that's the one with John Sack. No, it's not. That's the Umberto Lenzi one. That's right. Yes. I quite like that one, actually. It comes under the title. There's another title for it as well, which was quite good. And it had a sequel, I think, as well. There's Cannibal Apocalypse as well. So those four films are all very... That's the one with John Saxon. Those four films are all quite similar in their structure of, a documentary crew going down into the Amazon and getting attacked by a bunch of natives who are cannibals. But that's that's not the main focus of the film. That's almost like a subplot. And most of those films just generally become about animal killing. And it's really difficult to watch those films. If you have trouble with Ray Liotta's brain being served up with a bit of white wine sauce, these films have, I remember just, I had to close my eyes properly when I was seeing some of the killings that were happening in these films, because they were not, it's not right to see that. And I believe that some of them are still a bit cut because any form of torture is left out of them, because that's very not cool.
We were talking before about Cannibal Holocaust, and I was talking about the scene with the turtle being killed, which they, in the cut I saw, they had been left in. So I guess that's one of the scenes you're talking about.
I think where it's a clean cut kill, it's okay for some reason to put that in as entertainment, but whenever it's they toy with it for a while, which has happened, or it's killed in a very brutal way, then mm-hmm. they have to still keep it out. So some of them still have minor cuts to them, and people out there are championing to get the full uncut version on 4K because apparently they need it. But was it Cannibal Holocaust was the one that made the big headlines because it was brought to court that they had to present the actors to prove that they weren't actually killed, because it was so realistic. Mm-hmm. And that caused, this big upsurge in cannibal movies, because everybody wanted to see the shocking horror that was there. And not that they are particularly good in any way, but they became a hit thing for direct-to-video and video watchers to want to find and track down and get bootlegs of, with as much footage as possible in it. It was a whole thing. It was this really strange, surreal thing as well. And whenever you talk cannibals, you generally go to that more so than your mate Hannibal and Ravenous. And they're the ones that they go straight to you. And is it 28 years later as well? Has a good amount of cannibalism in it too?
I think my observation of having looked at cannibalism as a theme in the last couple of weeks is that early on, cannibal films tended to be set in jungles with tribes and, not in civilized society. And then slowly over time, possibly because of what you just said, it slid away into more thrillers and horrors of people eating each other within civilized societies, what we consider to be. And then I think it's further slid on, and it tends to be tied up with zombie films now as well. So everything has become away from the jungles, away from the Amazon, into New York, and also involving involving zombies at some point.
yeah, that's true. And was it the one with John Saxon? That takes place in New York, where there's a cannibal. I think it was even called Cannibal on the Streets or something. At one stage,
right
when it was first released, yeah. You've only seen that one, have you? You haven't ventured into Ferox Apocalypse or 77?
No, Ferox looks like another tits and arse film from the cover of the DVD. So all these kind of 1980s films that you like are clearly all top shelf of your mate's video shop with knockers hanging out of them, apart from the cannibalistic stuff going on. Is that not true?
I don't think so. I think whenever it came to these Italian films, they were very, very good at capturing good artwork that would entice the audience in, and you'd invariably be a bit upset by what you were seeing in the cinema because it's nowhere near as good as the poster. The poster artists are more talented than the actual filmmakers.
Yeah. Anyway, I haven't seen any of those other ones, but I have seen some of my own. We spoke already on the show about a really good cannibalistic-themed film called Dumplings, you might remember, a 2004 film, about this woman that is in this block of flats who is making soup for people, and it turns out, well, you can guess the rest. There's also Society of the Snow, which we spoke about and scored really well in our league table, that is a remake of the Alive film, so there's that as well. You just spoke about Cannibal Holocaust, so we won't do that again. I also watched a film last week called Little Bites, which is really good, and I've written a review about that. But the Lure, which is an Italian film about these two mermaids, and it turns out there's cannibalism going on in that as well. It just bonkers, bizarre films, some of these. But the two that I was going to focus in on, which you probably will know much better than I do, is the Hills Have Eyes films. Now, the original The Hills Have Eyes films was in 1977, and it was it had a sequel. Sorry, the remake of the first one was in 2006, The Hills Have Eyes. In between and after those, they made The Hills Have Eyes 2, and that was in early 80s, I think.
82, I think it was.
Right, yeah. Okay. And I thought that the both of the earlier ones were really not very good, very dated. It felt like an episode of some 1975 TV show, like Land of the Giants or something. And the script and the acting and the everything really was really bad. But there's a huge leap between that and the...
Actually, I'm going to put my glasses on and get my buck teeth out that you were talking about earlier. There's actually a Hills Have Eyes Part 3 as well, I think you'll find.
Okay.
It wasn't really, but it was titled as that when it was released, just to make some extra sales with some gory art. It was Wes Craven's Shocker or something like that.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that in a second, because I know that there are sequels in between all these, but the two I wanted to focus on was the original Wes Craven 77 one, which I think, as I say, is really, really dated, but the remake of it in 2006 I thought was much better. Now, I know that it's like 30 years later or 25 years later or whatever, so it should be much better, but it just felt like it was just much better acted. They throw much more money at it. The baseline story was done better. It was darker. It was more grisly. It was more sinister. It was better shot. The acting was actually really good. It was more gory. And they had a section at the end of it. I don't know if you remember, but at the end of it, they've got this kind of house where they spent about 20 minutes creeping around this house, and it was really quite suspenseful and spooky. These creatures were, you know, popping up left, right, and centre in this house, and they'd gone to town on the makeup and making those creatures very interesting. The backstory of this is that this family stumble into this part of the desert in America where the American military have been testing nuclear bombs, and there's a bunch of people that were left in the zone, and they turned into these kind of hideous creatures who are living there on their own and basically eating whatever they can find, including people, and just surviving. And they all look bizarre and odd, and they've in the first one they've carefully picked actors that kind of do look bizarre anyway, like the bloke from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I can't remember the actor's
Jupiter.
Name. But he already, obviously, as an actor, has a very quirky look about him. In the second one, it was obvious that they just used lots of makeup to create these people and creatures that were doing this stuff. But, yeah, my takeaway from this is, oh, yes, and there is a Silence of the Lambs crossover here, because Ted Levine in the remake, who plays James Gum in Silence of the Lambs, was Dad in the remake of The Hills Have Eyes. And it was really funny seeing him in something else again as well. So there you go. And something to do with cannibalism as well. So those were my two picks, really. So fill in all the gaps then of all that.
I do. I stand corrected. It was not Jupiter. It was Pluto. Sorry, he played the other characters. They're named after the planets.
Yeah.
Mars, Jupiter. It's Michael Berryman, who's got that sort of long, elongated head and hair. And it's very iconic on the front cover. I like the first one very, very much. The second one was an atrocity. And I've seen one of the remakes, or the remake series, just the first one. I haven't watched the second one yet. Which is my feeling. I've just never got around to it. It's a good series of films. I thought, I'm a bit confused now. I thought Ted Levine played the police sheriff in the remake.
No.
Am I getting confused with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where Arlie Emery plays the
He definitely the plays the dad. The dad that gets barbecued.
Okay.
there's a little spoiler for you.
Yeah. I'll have to revisit those. My watch list is now stocking up because I'm rusty. I don't remember them, to be honest.
But I also haven't watched the sequel one. So the Hills Have Eyes 2 remake in 2000 and whatever it was, 9 or 10 or something, I'm sure that that would equally, well, I hope that that would be equally as good, but I'll get to see it one day.
I do remember it coming out. Actually, no, hang on. I just went on to IMDb there, and I've rated it 2 out of 10.
Oh.
Hmm.
What, The Hills Have Eyes 2?
I'd say I've probably gotten confused and maybe was aiming for the original Hills of Eyes 2 from 84.
Ah.
And if I accidentally, I'll take that rating off.
Right.
And I'll rewatch it. Yes, okay. That would be sensible.
So, really.
Good series of films.
Yeah, I enjoyed those. But I also enjoyed picking off those ones that I mentioned earlier, like particularly Little Bites. Little Bites that I watched last week was just wonderful. A really good film. And I'll put a link in the show notes to that, because that's just sumptuous, essential viewing. Okay, your turn.
That's on Shudder.
It is, yeah. It was on Shudder, you're right, which often have some very good films and is worth the subscription, I think. It depends what you're into, doesn't it? We're into horror, though, and the theme continues next show, and it's your pick.
All right, well, I feel I do need to redeem myself after suggesting we watch Sorority Babes. So I'm going to treat you to a little classic horror film. It's from Italy, but it's an utter classic. It's from the director Lucio Fulci, and it's called The Beyond. Have you ever heard of it?
No. Tease it.
Yeah. I'm not teasing anything. You can just sit and watch it and go, wow, that was a quality horror film.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
It's his second best film, I'd say.
I've never heard of it, so I should look forward to seeing that and hope that it's in English or there's subtitles.
It is, yes.
Right.
And it could be your first David Warbeck movie as well, because he stars in it, and he's got a striking similarity to Roger Moore in most of his roles. And you, dear listener, can watch along with us and send us your thoughts, because I know The Beyond has a very, very loyal fan base out there.
You're right, okay. It's a shame I've never heard of it, but that's absolutely fine. I'm willing to learn, happy to learn, as long as it's not, I've got the word sorority in it, which I still don't know what it means, and I don't want to know. Let's move to the main feature and talk about our picks in there. I'm going to start off with The Long Walk, which I said I would come back to a little while ago in this very show. And this is this Stephen King adaptation into a film about this... The backdrop is that America is under military rule, and all the citizens that live in America are they're being surveyed and told what to do and got to do as they're told, sort of thing. One of the things in which they have decided to do is to have a long walk contest organised by the government as a way to inspire patriotism and a strong work ethic in the public. 100 teenage boys are selected via a lottery to compete. They must, and they are choosing to take part in this. Okay, they must walk continuously along a prearranged route and maintain a pace of over 3 miles an hour. If anyone drops below 3 miles an hour, they get a warning. When they've got 3 warnings, the next one they get shot dead. So the competition is that the boy who lasts the young man that lasts the longest, and it only seems to be for boys, not girls, gets a huge cash prize and the fulfillment of any one wish they desire for the rest of their life. So the event is highly publicised, and it's a bit, kind of a bit like Squid Game, which we've spoken about on the show before, but there seems to be some more kind of a backdrop to do with it. Apparently, Stephen King started writing this book in the 60s, and it was to do with Vietnam War and military drafting of young men, and how they were being chosen and sent off to their deaths, basically. So there's all that kind of stuff going on in King's head as well. But so as we go through the film, obviously 99 of the young men get shot dead in the end because someone has to win. We travel along with these guys, and they're talking to each other and teasing each other and getting very tired together. And the whole thing kind of turns into a thing about friendship and the meaning of life and what they're up to and camaraderie and blah, 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 blah. That's it, really. I'm not going to tell you what happens in the end, but that's the basis of the film. It's very well shot, and there are lots of interesting, gruesome, views of how, these people getting shot through the head when they don't conform with what they're supposed to be doing. And some of it's really, really cruel and miserable for them as well. Obviously, being shot through the head is quite miserable. And so I think it was quite a good film, and I quite enjoyed it, and I would recommend it.
Fair enough, yeah. It hasn't really enticed me. I've watched the trailer a couple of times, and I don't know. I don't fancy it, to be honest. It's not doing anything for me.
Okay.
I'd quite like to see it, giving Mark Hamill a juicy role is always a good thing, because he never gets the opportunity now, but
it's quite slow at times. It's quite slow, it plods along. The other film that I wanted to just quickly mention was a Studio Ghibli film, which is out there on Netflix now, I think, and on YouTube possibly. And this is one called The Secret World of Arrietty. And it's a lovely little animation. It's about this family of 4-inch-high people. They're called borrowers, and they have to live in the land of full-size humans, and they go around borrowing stuff to get by on and live by, which is...
Sounds familiar.
Stealing. Land of the Giants, yeah. So, actually, it is very Land of the Giants-ish, because they've actually done it very, very imaginatively. Where, for people of my age, if you watch Land of the Giants, you remember that they made huge cotton reels and pins and hooks and nails and stuff to get around the house with. And they've done this. Obviously, it's an animation, so it's easier for them in a sense. But they've made the set of the huge house around them really interesting, very imaginative, really well done, and it's a lovely little adventure. And you've got the token nasty woman who's the housekeeper trying to bump them all off. And anyway, you'll get the idea. If you know what Studio Ghibli films are about, I need to say no more. Good fun, really nice, gentle animation, and a lovely little film.
Very good. Yes. Do you like good Studio Ghibli? I always figured you would turn around and go, no, these are just cartoons like Daffy Duck.
not at all.
Not watching that.
I think they're really, really well done, the Studio Ghibli, or Ghibli, or whatever it's called. Cartoons, animations. Anyway, right, there you go then. Over to you now.
Okay. I have a new movie to talk about, which is unusual for me. But I grabbed this because my wife is a big fan of the subject matter. And I like two of the previous films that this is kind of based off of. And it's called Anaconda. It stars Jack Black, Paul Rudd, Steve Zahn, and Thandwe Newton and Danielle Melchior. There's a bunch of other people in the film as well, but I don't really know them very well. And it's directed by Tom Gormican, and it's not a sequel to the Anaconda series in any way. It's a film making comedy about them trying to make another Anaconda movie. And a couple of guys who just rattle together some money and head down to the Amazon and try to just, you know, guerrilla film it and make the film, and comedy hijinks happen. I was very close to putting it in the flop of the fortnight, so that tells you where this review is going to go. I didn't find it particularly funny at all, I don't think. I might have laughed maybe once. I find the approach that they had is you know, I think they're trying to recapture the energy that Tropic Thunder managed to get and succeed with, whereas this is a pale imitation. It doesn't seem to resolve itself very well, and it's really quite annoying because, you know, it's one of those films that has the setup of, oh, we're going down to film the film, and all these hijinks happen. But, you know, they manage to still put together a really quality piece of film that they can go and show to people because they manage to capture all the crucial moments that happened to them somehow, and gave them something to work with in the end whilst they were running around screaming from a giant anaconda that turns up halfway through the film. Paul Rudd, I have liked in the past. I'm not a big fan of here. He's kind of just doing that somewhat dim, but still intelligent enough to be able to keep things together. And then Jack Black is doing that kind of enthusiastic annoyance where he's still a bit dim, but it keeps enough together to be able to get through life. You know, they play off each other quite well. I was trying to work out the last time I'd seen Jack Black in a film, because he doesn't seem to make films terribly often, and I still haven't put that together. It was like maybe one of the Jumanji films or something. I can't remember. But the special effects are okay. This is 2025 now, and I'd say they're maybe a bit better than the Anaconda 3 and 4. I wouldn't say that they're any worse or better than the first Anaconda, or maybe the second Anaconda. The action sequences are, you know, they're comedic action sequences, and it's full of, you know, kind of crazy scenarios where they do things to the characters, and they have to try and, you know, deal with the silly thing that's happened to them. They get to run around reacting to how crazy things are in this world that they're in. I just thought this is probably the most forgettable film I have seen in such a long time. I'm actually struggling now, 4 days after watching this, to remember exactly what happened in it and how they managed to film the runtime. There's tiny elements of drama and, you know, bonding between the characters, you know, but they're more kind of comedy based than anything redeeming. I don't think this is going to be particularly well received by the larger audience. I think it'll have its fans that just, you know, Paul Rudd and Jack Black and Do No Wrong, those types of fans. But anyone else who goes to this expecting to see, you know, a raucous comedy that really, grabs and points at everything that's funny about filmmaking, is going to just, you know, not be terribly happy with the end result, because it's totally forgettable and not really worth your time. It's not wretched like Anaconda 3 and 4, but it's nowhere near as good as Tropic Thunder or Living in Oblivion or other comedies that do the filmmaking thing. And I know you hate films about films, but there are good ones out there, but this really isn't one of them. And I think this is what you think of whenever you're describing your hatred toward these types of things. Yeah. This very much marries up to that.
And also,
you're not interested in seeing it.
And also Jack Black, because I was looking through his filmography and I can't believe how many things he's been in. It's just absolutely tons and tons and tons. But the only thing I can see that I've actually watched that he's in it is this film called The Holiday from 2006, which is this girly, kind of sickly sweet film that we've spoken about before. And I do remember him from that. But the point I'm making, though, is that he just always seems to be the same character, doing the same thing, being the same kind of annoying, irritating oik in all he does. Not that I've seen much of it. But anyway, the point I was going to make was, going back to 1982, when he started out, he's got a humongous list of credits.
Yeah, 1982, was it? Wow, yeah. Because it's one of his first films was, it was a horror film, wasn't it? And he's just got some ropey line in it. I can't remember what that was then. And he's in Never Ending Story 3. Yeah, that's right. But King Kong, I'd say, is actually quite close to this, because he plays a similar character. He just lampoons that a lot more and makes it more of a comedy role.
And the other bloke you mentioned, Paul Rudd, I can't place him in anything. So these American comedy actors are just all a bit lost on me, I think, really. Oh, no, Death of a Unicorn, I've seen that. Who did he play in that? Elliot. Oh, okay. Yeah, I do remember that. Okay, I'll take that back.
Yeah. You do that. Do that. no, I don't mind Paul Rudd. He can be quite good and stuff. He was good in the recent Ghostbuster films. And was it Double Dragon? He was in back in the day, I remember, with peroxide white hair or something like that. There's some action movie back in the 90s he was in, and he just looked ridiculous. And he's in Halloween 6 as well. Yeah, that's right. What he's checking out.
Okay. Right.
So, yeah, it's very much avoid it if you think you're going to hate it, because you probably will.
Yeah, I will.
The other film I did watch is, because I'm quite excited about the sequel, I think it's already been released. I haven't checked in to see if I can watch it yet or where to watch it. It might be on Amazon Prime. I don't know. Is Greenland. Because Greenland 2, The Migration or something, has been released. And it was a film that was, I think Greenland took me a bit by surprise when I first watched it. I was expecting it to be really, really bad. And I enjoyed it. And then I kind of forgot about it up until the sequel was announced that it was going to be coming out, and it got caught up in a few different deals and didn't get released for about 4 years. So it's eventually arrived now. So I went back and revisited the original.
The sequel, you can apparently, according to Just Watch, you can't see in the UK, but you can. It is streaming in America.
Right. Okay. Well, that's all right then. Mm-hmm. Greenland's quite good. I suppose it's quite a political topic at the moment, but we'll not get into that. It's a basic story about how the end of the world is nigh, and Jared Butler and his family are able to go and hang out in one of the shelters that has been identified up in Greenland, and they have to get there, and on their way there they get into all kinds of adventures because planes explode and they get mugged and things like that. So everything's against them, but by gum, they're going to get there because Jared Butler and Marina Baccarina are just such formidable people. And it's great. I think it's really good fun, this film. It sounds like typical Armageddon-style nonsense that's been done a million times before. And it came just after that goofy, god-awful, but absolutely magic blockbuster that Jared Butler was in called Geostorm. It was just after that or just before that. So they were kind of about the same idea, where the world is about to perish. And Butler he takes it entirely seriously. The special effects are really decent. The action sequences are pretty spectacular. There's a few fights, a few stunts, and it's got a bit of a heart to it as well, which ain't bad. Scott Glenn turns up for about 5 minutes in the middle of the film, which is kind of welcome. The only thing that I sat thinking, no way is this accurate in any way, was that, you know, stuff works out for people, you know, where they get split up. The services that are set up, the military and the medical people, they communicate with each other, and they're able to relocate people that they've lost quite easily. And it's like, no way would that happen. No, not in the slightest. That's too convenient. But it's just a solid, stupid blockbuster. It's not that stupid, I suppose. I can't say that. It's, having watched Geostorm, which is genuinely stupid, this is a more mature, well-rounded, end-of-the-world movie. And it just proves that Jared Butler is really a formidable leading man in these sorts of capers. And I look forward to seeing the sequel. I've managed to avoid the reviews to see if it's any good or not. I think most people are thinking, well, it's just slipped out on streaming, so it must be bad. But I know a bit of the background in that it was, you know, a financial package that fell apart, and they're just trying to get whatever money they can for it, because it's not as bankable now as it was whenever it would have been released. So I'll give it a go, hopefully this weekend, and see if it's any good. But I think thumbs up for Greenland. It was, the first one was good. Have you seen it or are aware of it?
I have, and I reviewed it on this very show, and we spoke about it, but it must have been ages ago. When did it come out?
2020.
Yeah, so it was probably 5 years ago that we spoke about it. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was really, really good. And I remember saying at the time, it was a real good adventure yarn. It was pretty well made. Yeah, like you say, there was some stretching of stuff going on here and there. But apart from that, it just didn't seem to matter. I'm looking at the trailer now of the Greenland 2 migration, and it looks great. The tagline explainer is, the surviving family must leave the safety of the bunker and embark on a perilous journey across the decimated frozen wasteland of Europe to find a new home. So they must have somehow get across the Atlantic, I suppose. But yeah, it actually looks like it will be quite good. It's got the same two leads in it. And I, like you, am thoroughly looking forward to it. I think it's a neat little series so far.
Groovy. I wonder if this was... my wife tells me a story that we were walking along the coast and Jared Butler was there. She thinks we walked past him.
Yeah.
Because we do live fairly close to Paint Studios, which is one of the largest indoor studios in the whole of Europe. And I'm trying to work out what they might have been filming at the time. That was a few years ago, so it could well have been Greenland 2, or it might have been... No.
Something else.
Something else.
Yeah, that's cool. Anyway, there you go. Links to all that stuff in the show notes. And we are now... running nice and long. So let's get to coming soon before we run out of time.
All right, okay. Well, we'll start strong because I know you love these. You've been talking about them all week. Pinocchio Unleashed. This is a particularly crappy looking trailer for a new upcoming horror film that isn't Pinocchio, the one from 2026, or Pinocchio, The Water of Life, which was released in 2025, apparently, or Pinocchio Unmasked, which is coming soon, or Pinocchio Unstrung, which is coming soon, or Pinocchio Carved from Darkness. I've got a funny feeling that 2026 is going to be the year of Pinocchio. Ted, I know you like Pinocchio.
In the show notes there, you haven't linked to the trailer, and I couldn't watch the trailer because you had failed to populate the link, so it's too late now. So I can't see the trailer, but whatever it's about, I'm sure that I will enjoy it, because you're right. Like you were saying earlier about your growing up years, well, the same is true of me and Pinocchio, really, that as a child we were taken to Pinocchio, we got the record with the soundtrack, and blah-de-blah-de-blah, and Pinocchio is, I'm all over anything to do with Pinocchio, as you may have remembered. So there you go. I'll have a look at the teaser trailer after the show.
Okay. I'm a bit concerned about what you just said there, because comparing my upbringing in your upbringing, where I got to watch sorority babes paddling each other in their pants, and you're talking about going to see Pinocchio, I preferred my upbringing to yours.
Yeah, you're very sad upbringing. I had a proper childhood, and you obviously were introduced to filth at the very early age.
And it did me no harm. All right. Next up is a little film called The Devil Wears Prada 2. I am putting this in entirely because I think maybe Ted might be interested in it.
Oh,
because
you're joking.
God knows I watched the first one and, oh, Sorority Babes would be much more.
I'd rather watch Sorority Babes, yeah. I haven't
watched. Right.
This is the kind of film that my ex-wife would have been turned on by, the glitz and glamour of people pretending to be someone they're not and impressing other people and wearing high heels and makeup. And I can't think of anything more boring, to be honest. And I won't be watching this. To be fair, though, for people that like this kind of thing, it does look as though it's been really well made and the acting looks really good, and they've obviously thrown some money at it, so for those of us who are not vomiting at the thought of the content, I'm sure, you know, those people will enjoy it.
Yes, yeah, well, it's the 20th anniversary this year of the original film, so the sequel follows Miranda Priestley's struggle against Emily Charlton, her former, she's there, and stuff happens. At least you watched the trailer. I didn't. Next up is The Odyssey. This is a new film from Christopher Nolan. You may have heard of him. He is the biggest thing since Christ. After the Trojan War, Odysseus faces a dangerous voyage back to Ithaca, meeting creatures like the Cyclops, Polyphemus, Sirens, and Circle along the way. This is written by Homer from his, what were they called? Extended poems or something like that. They seem to be ignoring Homer's name entirely because Christopher Nolan is directing this, and that's going to draw in much more in the way of green bucks, you know, greenbacks.
Folding.
So, yes. What did you make of The Odyssey?
I have to admit to being really badly educated here about this kind of world, the stories, the mythology. It's just been off my radar, and I haven't really done anything at school or anything about this at all. But actually, looking at the trailer, I thought it looked like a really well-made, dramatic epic. And even if I don't know anything about this kind of world, I think it would be worth a try. I think it looks like it's really well made, and it should be epic fun.
Yes, yeah, it does look rather good. I did see, I think it was Alan hasn't been on in a while, so he hasn't mentioned him. The Critical Drinker has taken it down because of a particular casting. And I can't remember who it was or what it was for, but I think The Odyssey was one of those films that they say, or one of those books that is unfilmable, maybe. I know they made it with Armand Assante back in the 90s or early 2000s. It was either a miniseries or perhaps a direct-to-video film. But this does look big and bold, and it's got Tom Holland and Anne Hathaway and Matt Damon and Robert Pattinson. So it's got all the big names that people are going to want to go and see, and the type of names that people would associate with a Christopher Nolan film. So I imagine people are going to get a lot of good value for their money here.
Sure. That'll
be the one to see this summer. Unless, of course, it turns out to be absolute tat. I think his last one was like that, wasn't it? Tenant. Everyone was dead excited about it. Then they watched it and they didn't have a nice thing to say about it. Mm. Yeah, roughly. Next up is... Oh, yes. I forgot to put this in.
I'm glad for that reaction.
Well, I want to mention it because I do like the original a great deal. It was a 1980s comedy with Tom Hanks and Bruce Dern called The Burbs.
A 1980 comedy. American.
Yeah, but I think you would even like it if you watched it. It stood up quite well with the test of time, and it's got a good cult following. And a lot of people do tend to champion it from the 80s, not in the way that, you know, Ghostbusters and Back to the Future get championed. The Burbs is kind of, oh, yeah, if you liked it, yeah, you know. But there's a new TV series, an 8-episode TV series remake coming to Peacock called The Burbs. This is about a young couple who moves back into their husband's childhood home, only to face threats from the new neighbors and uncover the dark secrets of their cul-de-sac. Now, on the one hand, I quite like the idea of spending a bit more time with the Burbs, or with the characters from the Burbs. The other hand is that I would rather it be the characters from the 80s than all these new ones that they have established. But the cast is all right. I don't mind Jack Whitehall, and Paula Pell was funny in that sitcom she was in with Oswald Patton that I can't remember the name of now. It wasn't Community, it was something, maybe it was Community. I can't remember, but it was, yeah, she was funny in that. And then Kiki Palmer, I liked her in that Eddie Murphy film about the van, the security van that I reviewed on my website that I didn't mind. She was one of the best parts of it. Anyway, it looks rather routine, not terribly funny, but I'm just hoping that's an early trailer and initial reaction for someone who likes the original. What did you make of it?
I know nothing about this. I haven't seen the original, and it sounds dreadful, and I'm highly unlikely to watch this. But actually, it seems like it's a shame, really, because of making it into a comedy. They've kind of screwed with the story, which, if it wasn't a comedy, it could have. I think it had potential.
It was a comedy.
If they hadn't have made it a comedy, this film, that it had potential for being something actually quite good. It's a ghost story, a mystery, a kind of haunted house thing going on, and I think that had the makings for a really good, interesting story. But they just seem to have ruined it by making it into a comedy. And unlike you, I can't stand Jack Whitehall. He's got this kind of posh voice thing going on, and he just annoys me. I think I'd rather be called mate than watch him. But that's another story for another day, and I can't imagine for one minute I'm going to watch this. Next.
Fair enough. All right. Well, maybe give the original movie a go. It's darker than your typical American comedy. Mm-hmm. All right, the last one is a bit of a horror thing for you, but primarily for me. It's director Sam Raimi's new film. It's actually out now. I think it's already hit the cinemas. But we haven't discussed it, so I just wanted to throw it in because it's got a great cast, and it looks potentially quite fun and interesting. It's not your straight-up desert island film, because in the film, an employee and her insufferable boss become stranded on a desert island that are the only survivors of a plane crash. Here, they must overcome past grievances and work together to make it out alive. Or not. I'm busted to see what Sam Raimi's going to do with this. It looks like it should be sort of once and done. You know, it's that kind of two people on a desert island. They're either going to fall in love or kill each other. So we'll find out. But with Sam Raimi at the helm, God knows what's going to happen. Bruce Campbell's in it as well. So, hey. And I think it's going to be a blink and you'll miss him cameo. Dennis Haysbert's there too. So I think this got everything going for it. What did you make of this?
Looks like a film of two halves, if it follows the track of the trailer, because until the plane crash, it looked like a tedious American office tripe kind of program. But when the plane crash came along, I thought, oh, right, good, something's going to be a bit different now. And but then when you're expecting it to be something more meaty, all that happens when they're on the island is the office politics crap and juxtaposition of the reverse role, you know, the reverse role elements between them just carries on as if they were back in the office anyway. I think the survival idea would have been really good, but the comedy department have got involved in this, and they're going to make damn sure that it's not in any way serious on this desert island, but it's just a laugh, and they're making some comedy out of it. So another completely wasted opportunity. Sorry.
You don't watch many Sam Raimi movies, do you?
He rings a bell. Tell me one.
Okay. Yeah, Evil Dead.
I've seen...
Me to Hell.
I have seen The Evil Dead. Oh, so you reckon it's going to turn into a monster movie, do you?
It's Raimi, so it's difficult to tell what's going to happen, but it's going to have his trademark. There's going to be a sense of humour there that you don't have to dig into if you don't want to. You can get what you want away from it. There will be elaborate camera setups. There will be exciting energy. Raimi's one of the finest directors today. I know that his last couple of films, or at least the Doctor Strange film, was a bit kind of meh for people. But this will be him back in the horror wheelhouse, which he hasn't done horror since Drag Me to Hell. Which, if you haven't seen, absolutely worth it.
There was no
hint. The gift as well.
There was no hint of any of that in that trailer. It just looked tedious rubbish.
All right. Well, it's only the first trailer, and it's only a 2-minute snippet of the film.
Oh, you don't watch any breathe. Of the trailers for don't Evil breathe. Dead? I watched Don't Breathe. That was really good. That was when that bloke was in the house, and he couldn't see, and they had to all be quiet. Do you remember?
Yeah, he didn't direct that. He produced that.
Oh, did he? Oh, okay.
But I reckon you should watch Drag Me to Hell. That'll get you on form for this.
Okay.
You'll get what he's about, because it's terrific.
Drag Me to Hell. What year was that?
2009.
Yeah, there it is. I've got it. Have I seen that? Drag Me to Hell. No, I don't think I've seen that. Right, okay then. I'll take that on board. Okay.
You'll have a screen with that.
Let's move on quickly before we finish to the final curtain, and thankfully only one person in it, Gareth.
Well, yes, we've lost the wonderful Catherine O'Hara, who has been with us decades now, a comedy actress that had no equal. She was superb, beloved by everyone who saw her, right from the earliest memories of, what was it, Saturday Night Live, I think, or Second City she came from, sorry, Second City. Was that sort of Canadian group that came down, and she managed to carve out a wee place for herself in Hollywood, in the likes of Beetlejuice and Home Alone, obviously, came along soon after that. And she was known by everyone, actually, from Home Alone, I think, because it was such a huge hit, and she was such a such a well-known mother. She became everyone's mother from that. You know, popped up in all sorts of things over the years. I know her from The Paper and from Wyatt Earp as well. And Schitt's Creek was a long-running series that she turned up in with a pretty phenomenal role that she had in that. It was tailor-made for her. Herself and Eugene Levy has such chemistry in that show. Really is excellent. I take it you know Catherine O'Hara then?
I'm sorry, but I really didn't until I started looking this week. But I've just discovered that she was in The Last of Us, and the character she was in...
Yes, that's right.
I'm trying to track down who the character was, and I'm looking through...
Joel had killed her husband, and she met him in the place where they sanctuary.
Okay.
She's the writer, an alcoholic, I think, or something, but I can't remember.
Right, okay. But certainly, yes, Beetlejuice. But certainly not on my radar in the same that she was for everyone else's. Probably because I don't tend to go for American comedies again, because most of it seems to be, you know, heading that way. But very sad anyway. She's got a huge body of work, which goes right back to 1975. She was 71 apparently.
And actually I'd forgotten that she was in a lot of those Christopher Guest mockumentaries, you know, Best in Show and A Mighty Wind and what was the other one, Waiting for Guffman. They were three absolute corkers. If you like Spinal Tap, then you know that. That's much the flavour.
You really need Alan here for this, don't you? He would have had a lovely conversation with you about this lady, Catherine O'Hara, instead of me, who knows bugger all.
No, you're fine. You can go away and watch these. You've got 65 movies from this one show.
Yeah. Glenn Martin DDS, 39 episodes. No, that was a voice part. Forget I said that. I'm trying to track down something else I know her from, but I can't, so I shall stop now because we're running long. So, anything else to say?
No, very sad to see her go.
Yeah, indeed. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another podcast. Projector Room will be yours. In the meantime, you can catch up with Gareth Miles at garethmiles.com and check out his film reviews there, which are great. Do go and have a look at them. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find links to all of the other podcasts we do and all the MeWe group links and all the rest of that. You can also find them at PodHub UK. And you'll get the show notes at projectorroom.co.uk. They're also in your podcatcher. And yes, that's it. Let us know what you've been watching in the MeWe group, and we'll join you next time. And we'll hope you'll join us next time in a couple of weeks' time in the Projector Room.